This is Books for Breakfast, a podcast where we talk about books and writing. I'm Enda Wiley.
And I'm Peter Sir.
And you're all very welcome to this morning's show. And on today's show at the breakfast table, we feel very privileged indeed to have the wonderful writer Mary Costello. She'll be in to talk about her new collection of stories just published by Canongate, and it's called Barcelona.
Barcelona. They had not long arrived in the city. They had driven all day on the motorway, over high bridges and around wide sweeping bends, with cars speeding past and trucks bearing down on them, and only a low metal guard shielding them from the ravines below. The drive had terrified Catherine. She had kept her head down. David had not seemed to notice or hear her when she asked if they could please get off the motorway. Their hotel was on a narrow street off the Ramblas, where Picasso had once lived over a jewellery shop. They walked out into the bright shopping streets and parted company for a while. Catherine strolled around, in and out of expensive boutiques with gleaming tiled floors and semi-bare rails, through the covered market with its trays of tongues and hanging hams. Now and then she stood before a shopfront or a billboard. The colours of Spain, of Miro, everywhere. The afternoon sun beat down. Once she caught sight of David up ahead and ducked into a shop. She found a cafe down a side street and sat outside with coffee and a cigarette. Sometimes she thought she could live on cigarettes alone, silently, deeply inhaling, letting thoughts gather, coalesce, then purge themselves in the exhalation. Later, together, they walked in the shade of the plane trees on the Ramblas. The birds, locked up for siesta, were silent. Rabbits and tortoises, too. Canarios, 14 euros. Pico de Corral, 20 euros. Isabella's, 25 euros. Arrival in a new city often reminded Catherine of her youth, the pining for home she would feel on Sunday nights as her bus approached the city. And the orange lights up ahead bled into the horizon. Now her mind was crowded by details of the day, the drive, the week ahead. It was their fourth anniversary, and this trip, this city, had been David's choice. She knew he wanted it to matter, to mean something to them afterwards. Setting out that morning, she had brought up Lorca, whose poems she had taken with her. He was from Granada, or near Granada, she said. She looked out the window at the orange groves, the scorched headlands, the limpid day. He was murdered by the fascists in the 30s. It's still a sensitive issue here. David shrugged. Before they joined the motorway, she took out the poems. In the dark wake of your footsteps, my love, my love. They never found his grave, she said. See how the hyacinths line my banks. I will leave my mouth between your legs, my soul in photographs and lilies. She would have preferred Granada. She would have liked to find the mountain road near Alfalcar where Lorca was shot and buried. He was chasing Duende, she said. That's what he was after. She looked at David. Do you know what Duende is?
Thank you, Mary. That was Mary Costello reading the opening section of the title story from her new collection of stories, Barcelona, from Canongate. I was so excited to read these stories because I've been a big fan of Mary's all along. I know, Peter, you love her writing too.
Indeed, indeed. And just to introduce Mary, I mean, Galway-born Mary Costello's books include the short story collection, The China Factory, 2012, which was nominated for the Guardian First Book Award and the Irish Book Award, the novel Academy Street, which was published in 2014 and won the Bord Gáis Energy Irish Book of the Year and the Easton Novel of the Year, and was widely praised internationally, including by J.M. Coetzee, who makes an appearance in this new collection as well, which is the fruit of 10 years' work and her novel The River Capture, about a Joycean obsessive whose life is stolen, who's very immersed, or he's so immersed in Ulysses that he even thinks in its language and rhythms. That came out in 2019.
Yeah, so to turn to you, Mary, you're very welcome to the breakfast table here on Books for Breakfast. And one of the things that's immediately striking in this new collection is the number of animals in it, mistreated animals, that is, from a cruelly killed frog to a neglected dog. There's visions of animals, a skip full of hooves in the really shocking account of the slaughter of cattle in the final unforgettable story, The Killing Line. So it starts to feel more than incidental. It's more than just a narrative motif, and to seem more like something you feel really strongly about, Mary. Is that the case?
It is, and thanks for having me on, Enda and Peter. I think that writers, I can't speak for other writers, but I guess I write what obsesses me. I write what consumes me, and I write only what I have to. You know, it has to be essential. I wouldn't write if I didn't have to be honest. So there are a few things over my life that have really got to me. And one of them is the lives of animals, the suffering lives of animals, the lives of the weak in general, but in particular, the lives of animals, because it's the suffering of animals is so accepted. We all accept it. I'm culpable. I wear leather shoes sometimes. And I remember reading Milan Kundera said, the real test of humanity is our obligations towards the weak. It's a question of mercy, really, how we treat the weak in society and what mercy we have for those who are voiceless and defenseless. And of course, it's obvious we have that regard for elderly people, for children, for disabled, for minorities, for anybody who has no voice. But the group that has complete no voice are those who cannot speak, and animals. And I grew up on a farm, a beef farm. And I became a vegetarian in my 20s, and I ate a lot of meat up until then, I can tell you. But I always had to reconcile that conflict within me, because I benefited from the lives of animals. I was reared and educated on them. So, and my father was a very good man. He's passed away now, and he was a loving father and a kind, considerate man who practiced very good animal welfare. He was a very progressive farmer. So I cannot, you know, I cannot say, and we had very many robust conversations, and, you know, he actually used to feel great concern for me, because I went through a few very intense years of torture, especially in my 30s, when I saw animal suffering everywhere. You know, I'd drive up and down to Galway from Dublin, and livestock trucks would pass, or I'd see cattle or horses in a field, and I would see circuses parked up outside towns in the times when they would have animals in big containers and everywhere. And I can say that it really disturbed me, and I probably was in a bad place for a good while. So I would rant at home to my father, and he would be very concerned, and he'd say, Mary, why are you putting yourself through this? And, you know, so I couldn't blame him personally, because we're all culpable. Society decides to utilize animals. Society uses them every single way. So it eventually leaked into my work. I couldn't really face it head on, but the earlier stories would have some of them. In the first collection, there is a story called You Fill Up My Senses, named after the John Denver song, and the little girl is aware of lambs being castrated. But in this one, as I got older, you know, I didn't police myself in any way, but I managed to, it just seeped in a lot more overtly. And in 2014, that story that you mentioned, where the dog's being mistreated by the neighbour, My Little Pyromaniac, I had written that to the Irish Times, commissioned a story. But yes, the lives of animals are, it is a question of mercy for me. I can't look away.
That's fascinating, isn't it? And it is, because it is always in the story. I mean, it's kind of like an unthinking cruelty that happens a lot of the time. Just kind of almost like an unautomatic kind of thing that people just, they just don't think, or like that story, or so many others. Or here's a frog. Let's play a cruel thing, you know, trick, and you know, let's actually kill him. You know, this kind of thing. Another thing that's striking is how much of the action takes place either in cars, and you're talking about driving, and or while traveling, and it's as if kind of like motion or displacement causes the characters almost to examine their lives kind of more forensically or pitilessly than they might otherwise have done. I mean, there's a line, for instance, in Deus Absconditus that goes, "Travel makes of home a wound that accompanies him everywhere." But travel also sometimes seems it may be sort of like a hopeful thing or a kind of almost solitary togetherness. I was thinking of the story The Hitchhiker, for instance. And she thought of them permanently in transit, forever journeying together like this. And I was kind of wondering, is travel a big sort of trigger for you? And what is it about traveling that makes it such a powerful locus for writing?
Well, oddly enough, I don't like to travel much at all. I'm a real homebird. I like routine. I like very much being safe and at home. But then, of course, when I do travel, it is a very much, things do open up. I remember reading James Salter said that travel is necessary for a writer. I think McGahern hardly moved, you know, so it depends. But I do like, I find that when I go, when emotion does actually help. And I think I read a blog, I think, by Joyce Carol Oates recently about running. She runs, or she used to when she was younger anyway. And she also talked about the motion of something stirring. And writers who walk, I'm not a big walker, but oddly enough, in the oddest places, I don't like flying at all. But sometimes in the most awful circumstances of a really packed Ryanair flight with noise and smells of food and everything, I'll often find a space in my head for the notebook. It's something like there's something urgent and almost primal that you're up there and it could end at any moment. You're just in this tin can in the sky and there's something desperately urgent and concentrated about it. But I also love the small space of cars. I love to put characters into a small space like a car or a hotel room or a suburban home where there's a lot of intensity and feeling. It's a space really that is gold for a writer when you have two people and there's some conflict or tension. And it isn't that there's no escape, but there's an intensity to it. So the car, train, I do love those spaces. People are trapped together. In The Chalk Ice Woman, The Undertaker and Francis are in this hearse in a long journey. I also love suburbia. I lived in Dublin for 30 years and I lived in suburban homes and I know suburbia gets a lot of bad rap and I think Richard Ford loved suburbia as well. It's intense lives going on behind front doors, you know, it's everything. So I love that feel of suburbia as well. So yeah, I do like I like boundaries and concentration.
Yeah, well, there is a lot of that kind of gold intensity, as you said, in this book. And I really love that as well. And Peter and I are both based here in Dublin 8 in suburbia. So we love that as well. I often think about that, actually, the intensity of lives packed together in such a small space.
Excuse me. I wouldn't call this suburbia. This is the heart of the city.
Okay, but we're in a small little place within it, though. Mary knows where we are because Mary lived close here. But the hidden lives of characters are very much present in the collection. Couples and their unhappinesses, their betrayals, their hurts, the tangled relationships between fathers and sons. Peter mentioned Deus Absconditus and The Killing Line. Throughout these 9 stories, there's a sense of the fundamental loneliness at the core of these human relations. And I'm thinking of the story, My Little Pyromaniac, where you write, "There's nothing to explain how we humans can one minute lie down and reveal our most secret, vulnerable selves to each other, greet the other souls in the sex act, and then the next minute or the next day or week or month part and go separately into the world as if we are strangers, as if we've not left a burn on the other." And yet the burns are very much there, aren't they, Mary? So there's loneliness, yeah, but am I right in thinking that there's also the damage that we do to ourselves and to those we love or have loved? And that this is a theme that is prevalent throughout these stories. I mean, you said you want your characters to be rattled by something. I heard you say that somewhere in an interview. Is this what you were about in the stories as well?
Yeah, and it's not that I set out, you know, because these stories were written over 10 years and some of them were commissioned. But it's what unfolds, you know. I start with character primarily. Sometimes I'll have a character for a good while before I'll know the setting or the trajectory of the story, and something then will meet me, you know, I'll hear a story or something, I'll come on something and say, oh, that's where my character fits. But in general, one of the things that is a subject for me, not that I set out to do it, is moral dilemmas, moral paradoxes. A lot of my characters, most of the characters are good people, but they sometimes hurt each other and damage each other, and sometimes damage the integrity of the body even of someone else, like in the Chuck Ice Woman. So it's about the moral dilemmas. How do we continue to live and love somebody who's harmed us? Fathers and sons. And how do we reconcile? It's a matter of mediating opposites. You know, how do we recognize the opposite, reconcile opposites, like the Oliver and his father. Oliver is an academic, he's a vegetarian, his father is a beef farmer. So similarly with Frances and her husband, he has damaged her. She knows this, and yet she understands where he's coming from to a large extent. But yes, how do we ever know anybody? So it's about that alienation and that psychic distance that can exist between people who are family or loved ones, who might be married even. It's about a psychic distance and the private cruelties sometimes that people inflict on each other, not intentionally, and they might not be seem cruel to someone else, but it's about the private dilemmas and the private cruelties and the psychic wounds that people live with. And on the outside, nothing is noticeable. For instance, Frances is a librarian. She's gone to work. She's married. From the outside, nobody can see what she has endured. And similarly with Frank. And the other thing I think that is very important that matters to me is the issue of forgiveness and empathy and understanding that that's the issue of holding opposites. Somebody who's hurt and damaged and can still hold and understand where that, and perhaps even forgive the person who has hurt them. So these are the moral paradoxes, the moral dilemmas that the stories start out with. You know, I'm trying to write towards figuring out something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what I think. I got so much out of that in your stories, particularly in the book, The Chalk Ice Woman. Like, there she is, you know, damage has been done to her and she's still living with him. So I thought that story really stayed with me. In fact, I think it's a really great sign if you finish a collection of stories and the characters are still going around in your head. And it's lovely to hear you there speaking about them as if they're real people, because I did feel that afterwards they were kind of wandering around the house with me or coming down the street with me, which I think is great praise, you know, for a writer. They hear that from a reader.
And that journey, I'm still thinking of that journey in the hearse, that extraordinary journey in the hearse and what happens during the course of that journey, which is extraordinary. I won't say anything about it now, but it's brilliant. It's quite, I mean, I mentioned at the beginning of this, you know, I was talking about the river capture and about the man obsessed by Joyce and Joyce kind of getting into his bloodstream almost. And in another way, I mean, this is quite a literary book too, in the sense that it refers frequently to other writers. Kafka's Penal Colony, for instance, plays a large part in The Killing Line. John Cheever, I think, is mentioned in that story as well. And of course, J.M. Coetzee features both through his story Elizabeth Costello, but also at his appearance at a festival, very like The Stool in the story At the Gate. And I just wondered, is that a kind of deliberate strategy, or is it that those particular writers have meant a lot to you?
They have meant a lot, yeah. You know, I'm not alone in this. You're the same, I'm sure, both of you, but we spend a lot of time reading. You know, we spend a lot of time with writers. I spend more time with dead writers than I do with living family, you know. So it's where the head is and the heart a lot of the time. So they mean a lot and they're alive to me all the time. Like when I was writing The River Capture, you know, I'd always been a lover of Joyce, but of course, because Luke, that character, was so obsessed with him, I became every day more and more obsessed with Joyce. And, you know, I'd find it hard sometimes to believe he was dead. He died before he was even 59. You know, all of these sort of things would really get to me, and they make their way into the story then. But yes, it is how, you know, when you're a writer and a reader, the art lives in you every day. And I would find that my characters, I used to probably censor myself a little bit, especially when I first started writing, I'd be afraid, I'd be accused of, you know, saying, oh, she's planting this or whatever. But so now I write as it is, honestly and organically. So In the case of Frances, she was a librarian. And as often happens in our lives, we find parallels between our own lives and the lives in books sometimes. And that's how art works. It triggers or it resonates within us. So my characters, I'd be working on my characters and suddenly the story would veer towards something that would match it or somehow find a parallel. And then Coetzee, of course, is probably my all-time favorite living author and the one who means an awful lot to me because he is certainly has invested a lot of his life and his art into the lives of animals as well. But also he always tries to enter the characters fully. I think he's a very philosophical writer. I think he manages to mediate the thinking and the feeling function. Like he's a very rational thinking man. People think he's cold, but he couldn't possibly be cold because he writes with such feeling. I think he's very polite and very brittle, but he's also incredibly depthful. And I think he suffers for what he writes. So, and he wrote a book, his character way, way back, Elizabeth Costello, was a bit of a shock that he had the same surname. So I always love these sort of coincidences. But yes, it's the integrity of the writing. It's the refinement of the feeling. It's the exactitude and the truth of it. So, and I did go to see Coetzee in Listowel years ago. So that story has a certain, obviously, you know, we all write, I remember Coetzee himself said, all writing is autobiographical, but fiction and nonfiction, because it's coming out of us. But obviously the facts are always a little bit different. But yes, I did go to see Coetzee with my then boyfriend, and he found it, very hard to. Coetzee is very, very polite, extremely courteous, but also very brittle and doesn't suffer fool's glass. Yeah. And my boyfriend at the time was thinking, why are we this, you know? But of course, I was hanging on to every word, and it didn't happen as it happens in the story. But yes, it is a sort of a metafictional story. But yes, Coetzee matters to me. Kafka, of course, that Kafka story, as soon as I was writing Oliver, it emerged naturally that Kafka would, that story is, some of Kafka's stories mean a lot to me. He was interest in animal suffering as well. Musil's story, I remember reading that Tonka story years ago and just being blown away by it. You know, I've read some of The Man Without Qualities, a very difficult book, but it's, I can't honestly say I've read it. I've read portions of it, but the stories, three women, Musil stories about women are fabulous, you know, very bleak. And, you know, that's why it resonated with Frances, because Frank, her husband's life, had been sort of a bleak childhood, you know.
Is there a buried reference to a Derek Mahon poem in one of the stories as well? I was reading it thinking, oh, that sounds like a Derek Mahon poem.
There is, yeah, the mute phenomena.
Okay, I get that.
Yeah. Is that in one of the stories?
I think it is.
Yeah, oh, I love Derek Mahon. I mean, I think personally that, I love the mute phenomena. I know it's after Nerval. I think it's an interpretation after French. But, a disused shed. I know it's the very popular one, but I really think it's one of the best poems since The Second Coming or something. It's really fabulous, you know.
There's also, I mean, this kind of supplementing that, there's a sense of literature also as a kind of, and it's kind of like what you were saying about traveling to see Coetzee, but like literature sometimes is an alienating force where, you know, the female narrator in At the Gates talks about her husband having a mathematical mind, and though he easily kind of matches her intellectually, in the one area of literature, I surpass him. From the start, I was out of his league. And she says, I think he blames literature for the inwardness it conjures in me and for the fact increasingly he's lost access to more and more areas of my mind. Just a very interesting idea of, you know, the kind of interest in literature as a separating kind of force as well.
Yeah, I think it might be, you know, in couples where they're both not literary, whatever, and that one might feel that one is losing the other person into another realm, I think, because literature is, you know, if you do enter, you know, you enter another space all the time. And, you know, it's if one partner hasn't the same interest or the same access, it does mean a sort of a separation, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that in that story, actually. Irish writers are no strangers to writing about the Irish in America, Mary. And I'm thinking of Maeve Brennan or Colm Tabin, and your own novel, Academy Street, has Tess Loewen heading out on her own to the States in the 1940s to make a new life for herself there. But in Barcelona, there's one story, Assignation, where a young girl goes from the west of Ireland. She travels to America. She's employed by the kindly Cook family to mind their small daughter, Elizabeth. And it's the only story in the collection that goes back in time. And I was wondering, is there something about that era that attracts you as a writer? You know, that whole idea of Irish going out to make a new life in America for themselves. I was just wondering, you know, why are you attracted to that?
And it wasn't, again, it wasn't deliberate at all. It was commissioned by RTE. It's a story they did their centenary spoken stories centenary of the War of Independence Civil War celebrations, and I was thinking about it for a good while. Again, it's a quiet voice. I don't like stories with a lot of characters. So I love America. I love everything to do with America, or I used to. And I grew up on American TV, films, movies, as we all did, music. And so it always had that sort of attraction. I had aunts and uncles who immigrated to America. But one of the things that prompted in me was our independence, you know, the early years of the state and how we got independence, and of course how it was mired in all sorts of terrible sorrows and sadnesses and legacies. And here we have a young woman setting out in her life, but a great crime or tragedy happens before she leaves, so she must carry all that. So that's, again, it's about, I suppose, less about the exterior world as the interior lives of characters. That's where it goes. And America always has had that great attraction, you know, looking towards America for liberation, freedom, hope, which often doesn't materialize.
Yeah, and also without giving away too much, that she's carrying this deep trauma, and yet that's going to affect the choice that she's going to make in her life. I thought that was really brilliant. Again, another story that really stayed with me.
You've described yourself, Mary, as a reluctant writer, and you kind of you hinted at that again at the beginning of this interview. And I was kind of wondering, is that still the case? Would you still describe yourself as a reluctant writer?
I suppose, no, I can't say I'm reluctant. I'm probably a resigned writer at this stage, you know, because I used to say that because I had a few stories published in my early 20s, mid 20s, and then I gave up. I didn't give up writing, but I tried to give up writing because I didn't know if I could write, or didn't know if, and I have the confidence, and I wasn't in any writing circles. I was teaching full time and I was married. And so I did, but I pushed it down. You know, that's what I would always say, that I tried to give it up and I tried to be normal, what I thought might be normal, like my sisters and my friends. And it became it felt like a burden. I pushed it to the sidelines, but of course it wouldn't go away. So I was writing stories privately and quietly and a novel and so on. So, but I was in my 40s when I published. So, no, I wouldn't describe myself as a reluctant writer, but I remember reading, I think it was Keith Ridgway saying he wouldn't write unless he had to. And actually, a lot of writers say that. Joan Didion says she writes to know her own mind. If she knew her own mind, she wouldn't write at all. So I think that's what we're doing. I can only say that I'm straining always to put my finger on something. I'm writing to figure out something, to know what I think. And ultimately, what I think it means is I'm writing towards consciousness. I'm trying to put my finger, straining towards consciousness. That's all we can do. You know, people find meaning or become conscious through other, it might be through religion, or it might be through work or art or music or whatever. So that's the strain, that's the impulse or the urge. You know, some people do find it in God, in the divine. And, you know, maybe it's all the same thing. Maybe we're straining towards consciousness, some divine numinosity, something. But it's why there is an impulse to write.
Yeah, it's well described. And I'm thinking of T.S. Eliot as well, who said that he writes towards the essential poem, that he doesn't just write for the sake of writing. He waits for it. It's that essential urge. But Ron Rash, a writer that I absolutely love as well, he said about your fiction that it's always meticulously structured, her language precise. And you yourself, Mary, have said, I want no marks of labour on the writing. Is this hard won?
I suppose it is. I never did an MFA in writing or a master's in writing. I don't do workshops, so I don't really know how to unpack or take things apart. And I almost, reluctant to do that because I don't know how it's necessarily done. So I just do what I feel is very as truthful as I can do. I don't like ornate writing, I feel I would be afraid it would conceal or disrupt something or show off or anything like that. So it has to be, for me, as truthful and as honest as it can be. And in that sense, the style is bare. I don't deliberately set out to be that way, but I deliberately set out to be to get to the core of something as closely as I can. And yes, I do edit a good bit, and I read the work out loud when I'm editing. I obviously, in the early drafts, I don't print out for a while. I mean, I write a lot longhand. I have all notebooks. And when I have a lot accumulated in notebooks, I eventually start a story or a novel or whatever. I procrastinate a lot before I do that because I sort of dread it. I feel this dread. Will I be able to do this? Am I a one trick pony? I don't know. Many times I used to think that. So self-doubt is a big part of it. Will I be able to do this? Will I be able to pull it off? And then it's almost like putting a jigsaw together. And the deeper you go into it, the more things that drop down and help. And when you're in that mode, then you're doing it unconsciously almost. You're on the track for a while. I mean, it's terrible. Early drafts are terrible, but I'm still trying to refine it and getting closer to the heart of it. The old alchemist thing. It's not that I'm trying to find gold or anything, but it is like getting away all the surplus muck and mud and getting to as close to the essential thing as possible.
Yeah, that's true, Peter. We can identify, I think, with that as well. Just the curse of the blank page. But once you get going and start making a mark, things start to happen, I suppose. That's when the magic happens, if you're lucky. But Ron Rash also said, what I find most striking in Barcelona is an unrelenting clarity, which in a way is what you were talking about there, Mary. And he says, it forces us to confront the damage we do in this world to our fellow creatures as well as ourselves. And I thought this was a really kind of profound and accurate response to this really fine collection. It's been an absolute pleasure to read these stories. So I'd like to say thanks so much, Mary, for coming in and talking to us about this wonderful new collection just published by Canongate. And I think you're going to read us out now with an excerpt from a story that Peter and I have already mentioned. It's called My Little Pyromaniac. And I have to say, Mary, thank you for bringing Peter and I closer together, because he was upstairs reading the book, I was downstairs, and we'd meet in the kitchen. And then we'd go, did you read that story? What did you think of that? And we'd have big discussions. So thank you very much. You've made our relationship a deeper and enriched one. Okay, so thank you. So now we're going to conclude with Mary reading a little piece from My Little Pyromaniac. And thanks again, Mary, for coming on.
Thanks for having me, and Peter, it's a pleasure. My Little Pyromaniac. I had not thought of Kevin for a long time. Then, one evening last summer, just after I'd moved in here, he came walking out of the house next door. I was getting out of my car, and there was just enough time for each of us to acknowledge the other, the way new neighbours do, before he got into his own car. I walked to my front door, holding myself carefully, aware of the woman and children coming behind him, then the thunk of car doors closing. I stood in my hall, picturing the car moving along the street, the woman, his wife, beside him, the boy and girl in the back, he silent at the wheel, confounded by the sight of me after all these years, and the realization that I was now living next door, and the slowly dawning thought that from now on we might, at any given moment, be only a few feet from each other, standing in our symmetrically positioned kitchens, our bedrooms. All the houses in this cul-de-sac are semi-detached, inhabited mostly by families and young children or teenagers. In the evenings, the cars roll in, spilling out tired adults, children dragging coats and bags, sports gear, musical instruments. One evening, the little girl next door hopped out of Kevin's car dressed in a tutu. Her mother leaned into the back seat and took the child's bag and carried it into the house. She is a small, dark-haired woman and appears to be much younger than Kevin. The boy is about 10, the girl perhaps 7. I have watched them closely. I am not entirely convinced these are Kevin's children. When I was 19 and still at university, I fell in love with Kevin. He was 38. He had a handsome, hewn face, a little like Warren Beatty's. He worked for a large investments company and lived in a beautiful Victorian red brick with lamp-lit rooms and stained glass panels in the front door. He was often abroad on business, and sometimes a week or two would go by before I heard from him. Then we would meet, and if it suited him, I would stay over.
Thank you very much, Mary Costello. I think we've reached the end of our Books for Breakfast podcast this morning. I'm definitely rushing off to have more coffee. And I'm Enda Wiley, and I have Peter Sarah here with me. And Peter, would you like to tell everyone about the details of the podcast if they'd like to listen again?
Well, you can subscribe at all the usual sources, Google and Apple and so on. And if you want to check out the notes that go along with this podcast, you can go to booksforbreakfast.buzzsprout.com. And yeah, so
we'll be back again. We'll have the toast on. We'll have the kettle boiling. We will have more books to discuss. And we're looking forward to having you here. So goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.